This is Lecture 6 of the series Inflation and Price Controls.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. On the basis of the knowledge we have acquired of a free market, we are now in a position to undertake a comprehensive, systematic study of the effects of price controls. Let us begin to do so. If I were asked to name the one consequence of price controls that I believe is the most fundamental and important from the point of view of explaining all of the others, I would answer that it is the fact that price controls cause shortages. In tonight's lecture, I will explain exactly what I mean by shortages and how price controls cause them. I will then examine the ignorance and evasions that surround the connection between price controls and shortages, and which lead people to blame shortages on things other than price controls, such as alleged conspiracies on the part of private companies. After that, I will begin a systematic presentation of the further effects of price controls operating in conjunction with shortages. What I mean by a shortage is an excess of the quantity of a good buyers are seeking to buy over the quantity sellers are willing and able to sell. An excess of the quantity of a good buyers are seeking to buy over the quantity sellers are willing and able to sell. In a shortage, there are people willing and able to pay the controlled price of a good, but they cannot obtain the good. The good is simply not available to them. Experience of the gasoline shortage of the winter of 1974 should make the concept real to everyone. The drivers of the long lines of cars all had the money that was being asked for gasoline and were willing, indeed eager, to spend it for gasoline. Their problem was that they simply could not obtain the gasoline. They were trying to buy more gasoline than was available. Now, please observe that the concept of a shortage is not the same thing as the concept of a scarcity. An item can be extremely scarce, like diamonds, Rembrandt paintings, and so on, and yet no shortage exist. In a free market, as we saw in last week's lecture, the effect of such a scarcity is a high price. At the high price, the quantity of the good demanded is leveled down to equality with the supply available, and no shortage exists. Anyone willing and able to pay the free market price can buy whatever part of the supply he wishes. The height of the market price guarantees it, because it eliminates his competitors. It follows that however scarce a good may be, the only thing that can explain a shortage of it is that its price is prevented from rising to its free market level. That means the only thing that can explain a shortage is a price control, not a scarcity. It is price control that prevents the price of a scarce good from rising to its free market level, and thus reducing the quantity of it demanded to equality with the supply of it available. Of course, if a price control on something exists and a scarcity of it develops or grows worse, the effect will be a shortage or worsening of the shortage. Let me put it this way. Scarcities can cause shortages or worsen them, but only in the context of price controls. If no price control existed, the development or worsening of a scarcity would not contribute to any shortage. it would simply send the price higher. Observe further. A shortage can exist despite a great physical abundance of a good. For example, we could easily develop a severe shortage of wheat in the United States with our present supplies or even much larger supplies. That is because the quantity of wheat demanded depends on its price. If the government were to roll back the price of wheat, it would create a major additional demand. Not only a larger export demand, but a larger demand for raising cattle and broilers, making whiskey, and perhaps for many other employments, for which one does not presently think of using wheat because of its price. In other words, no matter how many billion bushels of wheat we now produce, or might produce in the future, we could have a shortage because at an artificially low price, we could create a demand for an even larger quantity. So please hold in mind that shortages are not a matter of scarcity or abundance. Scarcity need not cause them. Abundance is no safeguard against them. Shortages are strictly the result of price controls. Price controls are the only thing that allows scarcities to cause shortages, and they create shortages even when there is no scarcity but abundance. Indeed, I would like you all to realize right away that the true relationship between scarcities and shortages is the reverse of what is usually believed. The true relationship is that shortages cause scarcities. That is, no matter how abundant are the supplies with which we begin, we have only to impose price controls, create a shortage, and we will soon bring about a growing scarcity. As an example of this, consider the fact I pointed out last week that in the oil crisis, oil men needing oil products to keep their wells running were prohibited from outbidding homeowners needing oil to heat their garages. Think of what such a thing is capable of doing to the subsequent supply of oil. The demonstration of this relationship between shortages and scarcities, that it is shortages that cause scarcities, will be a recurring theme in all of the remaining lectures in this course. Now, in a free market, shortages are a virtual impossibility. The closest thing that exists to them is that sometimes people may have to wait in line for the next showing of a popular movie. The typical case in a free market is that a seller is in a position to supply more than his present number of customers. There are very few stores or factories in a free market that are not able and eager to do more business. Even goods and services in limited supply are priced in such a way that the sellers are usually able and willing to do more business. For example, the wine shops have some reserve inventory of the rare wines. Landlords have a certain number of vacancies. There is even some limited degree of unemployment in most occupations. This is because, in a free market, the prices of goods and services in limited supply are set somewhat above the point that would enable the sellers to sell out entirely and the workers to be 100% employed. The reason prices are set this way is because the sellers, including the workers, believe that by waiting before they sell, they can find better terms. They are holding out, waiting for the right customers or the right job. Let us observe further how price controls cause shortages. There are two basic ways. The first is that they expand the quantity of an item demanded. The second is that they reduce the amount of it supplied. Please keep in mind that a controlled price is an artificially low price. a price below the price that would prevail in a free market. To the degree that the controlled price is below the potential free market price, the quantity of the item demanded is enlarged. People can afford more and more of it with the same monetary wealth and income. They can carry its consumption to a point of lower and lower marginal importance. At the same time, the quantity of the item supplied falls in all of the following cases. One, if the item is a product, the quantity supplied falls if the price control makes its production unprofitable, or simply less profitable than most other branches of production. Observe, it is not necessary that a price control make production unprofitable or insufficiently profitable to all producers in a field. Production will tend to fall as soon as it becomes unprofitable or insufficiently profitable to the highest cost or marginal producers in the field. These producers begin to go out of business, or at least to operate on a smaller scale. Their place cannot be taken by the more efficient producers because the same price control that drives them out of business restricts the profits of the more efficient producers and deprives them of the incentive and also the capital required for expansion. In fact, even the more efficient producers may not be able to maintain operations and may be driven out of business sooner or later. For example, the price controls on oil have held down the supply of oil. They have not totally destroyed the supply of oil, but they have made the development of high-cost sources of supply unprofitable, such as oil from shale rock and even from the continental shelf. They have also made the more intensive operation of existing wells unprofitable. At the same time, they have restricted the profits from the lower cost oil deposits and thus held down both the incentives to discover such deposits and the capital that would otherwise be available to the oil companies for expanded exploration and research and development. Rent controls on housing that has already been constructed provide a similar example of the destruction of supply. Gradually, as the operating costs of housing rise, namely such costs as fuel, maintenance, taxes, and minor repairs, more and more landlords of rent-controlled buildings are forced to abandon their buildings and leave them to crumble. The reason is that once the operating costs exceed the frozen rents, continued ownership and operation of a building becomes a source merely of fresh losses, over and above the loss of the capital originally invested in the building itself. This destruction of the housing supply starts with the housing of the poor and then spreads up the social ladder. It starts with the housing of the poor because the operating costs of such housing are initially so low that they leave little room for economies. For example, there are no doormen to eliminate, and therefore no doormen's salaries to save. Also, the profit margins on such housing are the lowest to begin with, because the land and the buildings are the least valuable, and therefore the amount of profit earned is correspondingly low. As a result, the housing of the poor is abandoned first because it provides the least buffer between rising operating costs and frozen rents. Now let us consider a second major type of case in which price controls reduce supply. A price control reduces supply whenever it is imposed in a local market and makes that market uncompetitive with other markets. In such a case, the local market can be prevented from drawing in supplies from other areas. A price control, and this is a case that we saw in Lecture 4 in discussing the effects of the Arab oil embargo on the United States. A price control can also cause a local market that normally exports to export excessively. In this case, as supplies are drawn out, the price control prevents the people in the local market from bidding up the price and checking the outflow. This phenomenon occurred in this country in 1972 and 1973. Our price controls on wheat, soybeans, and other products made possible an unchecked exportation that jeopardized domestic consumption and led to an explosion of prices each time the controls were taken off in President Nixon's succession of on-again, off-again phases. I should mention, by the way, by way of a momentary digression, that a further factor involved in this case was the devaluation of the dollar in terms of foreign currencies. When President Nixon imposed price controls in August of 1971, he also devalued the dollar by 10%. In 1973, the dollar was devalued again. A devaluation of the dollar meant a lower price of dollars in terms of marks, francs, etc. That's all devaluation means, a fall in the price of a country's money in terms of foreign monies. Since the prices of our goods were frozen, a lower price of dollars meant that all of our goods suddenly became cheaper to foreigners. As a result, they began buying in much larger quantities, especially our agricultural commodities. And as they began buying, domestic buyers were prevented by price controls from outbidding them for the dwindling supplies. As a result, years of accumulated surpluses were swept out of the country and domestic food supplies were threatened, which is why prices skyrocketed each time the controls were taken off. Three, a price control reduces supply whenever it is imposed on a commodity of the kind that must be stored for future use, and encourages a too rapid rate of consumption of that commodity. To elaborate on an example from Lecture 4, if the wheat harvest were short by an amount equal to 1 month's normal consumption, and a price control were imposed which prevented any rise in price, then consumption would go on at the usual rate, and at the end of 10 months, there would be 2 months to go and only 1 month's supplies left. In this case, price controls would have sacrificed the supplies of the last 2 months to the first 10 months. In principle, this is their effect every time they cause the consumption of something that a free market would store for future use. Four, a control reduces supply if it is applied to the wages of any particular occupation or to the wages paid by any particular industry, while wages in other occupations or industries are left free. In these cases, the workers in the controlled occupation or industry simply leave to take better paying jobs at uncontrolled wages elsewhere, and new workers do not enter the controlled occupation or industry. The controlled occupation or industry is made uncompetitive and loses its labor force. For example, if the government were to control just the wages of steel workers, say, the effect would be that steel workers would start going into other industries in response to higher uncontrolled wages in those industries. Young workers would stop becoming steel workers. Exactly the same thing would happen if the government controlled just the wages of carpenters, say. Five, a price control reduces supply whenever it applies to some products of a factor of production, but not to other products of that factor. In this case, the production of the controlled products is curtailed because it is more profitable to use the factor of production to produce the uncontrolled products. For example, if the price of milk is controlled but cheese is not, then the production of cheese will be more profitable than the production of milk. As a result, raw milk will be used more heavily to produce cheese, and less milk will be available for drinking. In other words, the supply of milk available for drinking will fall. In all of these five ways, then, price controls act to reduce the supply of goods or services subjected to them. The reduction in supply, combined with the increase in the quantity of a price-controlled good demanded, is what creates a shortage of the good. Now, it may be thought that price controls on genuine monopolies, such as government-franchised electric utilities, are an exception to the principle that price controls discourage production. In fact, they are not. Indeed, they are an excellent illustration of it. In normal times, that is, in the absence of inflation, or when inflation is proceeding very moderately, these controls on the monopolies are largely without effect. By that I mean they do not actually impose below market prices. At such times, they are set at a level that, if anything, is almost certainly higher than would have prevailed in a free market. This is the case because they are set high enough to provide the going rate of profit and then some to legally protected monopolists. The costs of production of these monopolists are almost certainly above the costs of production which would prevail in a free market. But in a period of more rapid inflation, such as has characterized the last decade, the price controls on these monopolies cease to be above the potential free market prices. They begin to operate as genuine price controls. This occurs because inflation drives up the production costs of the monopolies, while the regulatory authorities either refuse to allow rate increases or allow only insufficient rate increases. In this way, the utilities and all the other regulated industries become unprofitable. At first, they merely cease to grow rapidly enough because their restricted profitability throttles their ability to generate additional capital. That is, they both lack the profits to plow back and they lack the profits to provide an incentive to the investment of sufficient additional outside capital. When the reduced profitability of these industries is understood to be permanent, however, or when the policy of the regulatory agencies inflicts actual losses on them in terms of making it impossible for them to replace worn-out equipment at higher prices, then these industries go into an actual decline. At that point, they do not have the means of replacement, and their owners withdraw capital to whatever extent they are able in the form of taking dividends. We are already well into the first phase of this process. Areas such as New York City, for example, have been skirting for several years on the edge of power disasters. Every summer, there is a question of whether generating capacity will be adequate to meet the demand. That things were not much worse last summer than the summer before is probably due only to the recession, which has sharply cut back the growth in demand for power. This situation of the demand for power threatening to outrun the supply in places like New York City is the result of the rate controls on the utilities, compounded, of course, by the ecology movement and a growing burden of taxation. The two latter have combined with inflation to drive up costs. All of this has acted to restrict the profits of the utilities for many years, and thus to prevent the construction of sufficient generating capacity to keep pace with demand. At the present time, in the lapse of all-round controls, the traditionally regulated industries, such as the electric utilities, the telephone company, and the railroads, are the principal victims of controls, along with rental housing and the oil and natural gas industry. They are literally being destroyed by them. And since the rest of the economic system is vitally dependent on them, their destruction implies disaster for the entire economy. Their total destruction, of course, will not be immediate. And until now, the harm has been in the form of restricted growth rather than actual decline. But the actual decline must occur as soon as it is realized that the profitability of these industries is going to be impaired indefinitely in relation to that of other industries. The decline will occur simply as the result of these industries lacking the funds to replace their assets at higher prices and not being able to attract fresh outside capital. Let us pause for a moment and consider what we can already see ahead if inflation and price controls continue. What must lie ahead in that case is the specter of power shortages, shortages that will grow worse as the electric utility industry declines. These shortages will mean an inability to operate electrical appliances and a need to resort to more primitive methods of production that substitute human muscle power for machinery driven by electric power. It will mean periodic brownouts, then blackouts, as whole areas are put on reduced power and then totally deprived of power at specified intervals. Telephone service will collapse. The railroad network will disintegrate. The oil and natural gas industries will be destroyed. All of these industries will be reduced to the level of rent-controlled housing in New York City. All of this destruction is already in progress. There have been clear signs of it for years. Now, I want to stress as strongly as possible that none of this destruction is necessary or inevitable. If it happens, all of it will be the result of ignorance and irrationality. There is a simple, clear-cut way to prevent these results. The very best way, the optimum solution, would include two measures. One, an end to inflation and the establishment of a full gold standard. And two, the repeal of all price controls, and in the case of the monopolies, such as the electric utilities, the repeal of exclusive government franchises as well. This last would deprive them of their monopoly character and of the ability to set monopoly rates. A third measure would also have to be included, namely an end to the harassment of energy producers by the ecology movement. I realize that this solution may be regarded as utopian. Nevertheless, it is the right solution, and it provides the only practical standard by which we can gauge the actions we should take and that are open to us. If we do not have the power immediately to stop inflation, we do have the power at least to make it go slower. If we do not have the power immediately to repeal price controls, we do have the power to see that they are relaxed or applied less stringently rather than more stringently. We have this much power at least simply by voting for less bad political candidates. But within a few years, we could do much more than this, as I will indicate in Lecture 9. Now, on the basis of all of the foregoing, I believe that we can take it as an established fact that price controls cause shortages and that only price controls cause shortages. Nothing but price controls cause shortages. Nevertheless, this elementary knowledge, which has been known to all economists worthy of the name, at least since the time of Adam Smith, is either unknown or simply evaded by almost all of our presumably educated political and intellectual leaders. These people do not have any idea of the connection between price controls and shortages. In their view, shortages are the result of some kind of physical deficiency in the supply or of an innate excess of needs. They simply do not have any knowledge of the role of price in balancing demand and supply. As a result, it is common to hear them blame shortages on such things as poor crops, an alleged depletion of natural resources, even that old standby, the greed of consumers. Their level of knowledge is typified by a provision of the rent control law that governed New York City for many years. According to this law, rent controls could not be lifted until the vacancy rate in apartments had first climbed to a certain substantial level. In other words, only when the shortage that rent controls created and maintained was over could rent controls be lifted. To find a parallel for this kind of reasoning, one would have to find a badly overweight person, say, who has firmly resolved to go on a diet just as soon as he lost 20 pounds. Or an alcoholic who has firmly resolved to stop drinking just as soon as he sobered up. Of course, these are not perfect analogies because the overweight person and the alcoholic at least know the causal connections and are evading them. In the case of the government officials and the intellectuals responsible for rent control, most of them don't even know the causal connection. They are too ignorant to be guilty of evasion in this particular instance. Now, I must point out that in an important respect, the ignorance that surrounds the effect of price controls is made possible by the effect of inflation on the nominal rate of profit. This permits the supporters of controls to look at an industry that is in the process of being destroyed by price controls and to believe that the industry is earning a high rate of profit and in no way suffering. As we saw in Lecture 2, inflation raises the nominal rate of profit. Because of this, it can appear that the controlled industries are earning a rate of profit that by all customary standards should be more than adequate. The supporters of the controls point to the fact that the nominal rate of profit of the controlled industries is as high or higher than what has traditionally been considered a good rate of profit. And they attack the pleas of the controlled industries for a still higher rate of profit as, quote, unconscionable greed, and even demand that it be reduced from heights they claim are already, quote, excessive. To fully understand what is involved, it will pay us to spend a few moments examining further the effects of inflation on the nominal rate of profit. Back in Lecture 2, we saw how inflation artificially raised profits on inventories. Now let us see how it artificially raises profits on so-called fixed capital, that is, on capital invested in machinery, factory buildings, apartment houses, and so forth. If you look at page 2 of the handout you received this evening, you will see the following example. We assume that a machine, or it could be a building, or any form of fixed capital, initially costs $1 million. This is shown as item 1. For the sake of simplicity, we assume that it lasts 10 years. Now, the most common accounting method is to spread the cost of such a good evenly over its life. In this way, we arrive at an annual depreciation cost of $100,000 per year, which is item 2. This $100,000 a year is supposed to be recovered out of the revenue of each year, that is, out of the sales receipts, rents, or whichever that the firm takes in, and when saved up over 10 years, should suffice for the purchase of a second replacement machine. In the left-hand column of your handout, the column labeled Profits Without Inflation, item 3, I show a hypothetical income statement of the firm, which describes its annual operations on the assumption of no inflation. I assume that each year the firm has sales revenues of $1 million and operating costs of $850,000. These operating costs are the costs of labor, materials, fuel, advertising, and so forth. For the most part, they are outlays made in the current year to keep on producing, given the fact that the firm already owns the fixed capital, the machine. When we subtract operating costs from sales revenues, we arrive at gross profit. And when we subtract depreciation from gross profit, we arrive at net profit before taxes. The profit remaining after all costs but taxes have been deducted. For the moment, we will ignore taxes. In our example, as we see, gross profit is $150,000 per year, and net profit is $50,000 per year. The rate of profit in our example is 10%. We arrive at this figure by dividing the $50,000 amount of net profit by $500,000, which is the amount of capital invested in the machine on the average over its 10-year life. Please observe, $1 million is invested in the machine only at the beginning of the first year. Thereafter, as depreciation is recovered, the amount of capital invested in the machine is steadily reduced. At the end of year 5, only $500,000 remains invested. And at the end of year 10, nothing remains invested. The average investment, taking the balance of all the years, is only $500,000. Hence, the rate of profit is 10%. Now, let us assume that this 10% rate of profit is normally a very good rate and is competitive, or even more than competitive, with the rate of profit in industry generally. So far, then, all is fine for the particular industry concerned. But now let us observe the effects of inflation, and then of the government's attempt to keep the industry's profit at this initial rate. For the sake of simplicity, let us imagine that sometime after the firm has bought its machine, and before it must buy a replacement machine, inflation brings about a doubling of all prices and wages. We could imagine this doubling to take place gradually over a period of years or all at once. In either case, we reach the income statement on the right-hand side of the handout labeled Profits with Inflation, item 4. In that income statement, sales revenues are doubled because the firm sells its goods at twice the price. Operating costs are also doubled because the firm must pay twice the prices and twice the wages for everything it buys. With a doubling of both sales revenues and operating costs, gross profit too is necessarily doubled. It is now $300,000 instead of $150,000. But now, please observe, there is one vital magnitude that has not doubled but has remained the same, namely depreciation. That cost is based on the initial cost of the machine, not its replacement cost. Inflation doubles the price of a new replacement machine, but it does not act retroactively to double the price already paid for the firm's present machine. Hence, depreciation cost, which is based on the price actually paid for the machine in the past, remains unchanged. Because depreciation cost remains unchanged while gross profit increases, the effect is a disproportionately large increase in net profit. In our example, net profit quadruples, going from $50,000 to $200,000. The rate of net profit, therefore, also quadruples, going from 10% to 40%, as the quadrupled amount of profit is divided by the same capital base. Now, this 40% rate of profit is, in fact, no greater in terms of benefit to the firm's owners than was the initial 10% rate of profit. Because if they want to stay in business and replace their machine, they have to devote most of their extra profit to saving up for a replacement machine at a higher price. Since they ultimately will require $2 million to buy a replacement machine, what this means is that they must use at least $100,000 a year of their additional net profit for this purpose. They must accumulate an extra million to pay a $2 million price for the machine, and that means they have to accumulate an extra $100,000 a year. Consequently, while their net profit appears to give them a gain of $200,000 a year, actually, they dare not consume more than $100,000 a year without impairing their ability to stay in business. And because all prices have doubled, the consumption of $100,000 does not enable them to buy any more goods than $50,000 previously bought. In this way, the $200,000 profit with inflation is really no greater than was the $50,000 profit without inflation. And thus, the 40% rate of profit with inflation in reality signifies no more than did the 10% rate of profit without inflation. It is purely a nominal rise, not a rise in the real rate of gain to the firm. Indeed, as a result of inflation, the firm actually has to be worse off because its owners cannot continue to buy as much as before if the firm is to stay in business. If for no other reason, this must be the case simply because the firm must pay additional taxes on its higher nominal profits. If you look at the handout, you will see that the firm's after-tax profit, assuming a 50% tax rate, goes from $25,000 a year to $100,000 a year. However, in order to replace its machine, the firm would have to have such profits for the full 10 years and use the whole of them to accumulate a replacement fund. Observe, initially, without inflation, the firm could replace its machine and had $25,000 left over every year for expansion or for its owner's consumption. Now, with the $100,000 profit, it has nothing available for expansion or for its owner's consumption because the entire $100,000 profit must be used to accumulate the extra money required to replace the machine. I show this by entering an additional item below net profit after taxes. That is the item, necessary provision for replacement of machine at higher price. Without inflation, this item is none. With inflation, it is $100,000. And as a result, the real profit of the firm is none. Now, in the light of this example, consider the consequences of the attitude that the old rate of profit is good enough. Our example shows that in the context of inflation, even the highest rates of profit that firms can earn are not good enough. Because as we have just seen, even these rates represent a decline in real profits and quite possibly a total elimination of real profits. In such circumstances, to argue that because a rate of profit is high by historical standards, it is high in any meaningful sense, is to display the utmost ignorance. To limit an industry's profits in any way in such circumstances is simply to invite its destruction. But precisely this is what is being done today to the electric utilities, the phone company, the railroads, and the oil and natural gas industries. And it is what has been done to the rental housing industry in New York City for almost 35 years. Until quite recently, for example, the government of New York City was proud of the fact that it guaranteed to landlords under rent control the right to earn a 6% rate of return on their initial investments, made in most cases before World War II. 6%, reasoned the city officials, was a fair rate of return. What honest landlord could want more? The city officials neglected the fact that since the landlord's initial investments were made, replacement costs had increased many times over, and that a 6% return on the construction costs of a generation or more earlier had to represent a disastrously losing proposition. Amazingly, when landlords began to stop keeping up their properties as a result of such loss-making conditions, they were the ones accused of milking their properties. As though the city or the tenants had originally constructed the buildings, and the landlords were now trying to squeeze out of them whatever they could. The simple truth is that the city government of New York, with the support and participation of hundreds of thousands of ignorant tenants, has milked the rental housing industry to the point of totally destroying vast segments of it. The same fate now awaits other, more important industries in this country that are suffering from price controls. What is at root in these cases of wholesale industrial destruction is not ignorance alone, but a mentality that makes itself ignorant. The ignorance, I believe, is largely made possible by a protective shell of envy and resentment. People take the attitude that somehow the utilities, the landlords, the oil industry, or whoever are, quote, already rich enough, and that they'll be damned if they'll let them get any richer. So on with the price controls. This is the beginning and the end of their thinking on the subject, and they just don't care to think any further. They are eager to accept high nominal profits as a confirmation of their view that the industries concerned are rich enough, in quotes, and to let it go at that. Now, the simple fact is that none of these industries is rich enough, and in preventing them from becoming richer, or even staying as rich as they are, people foolishly harm themselves. None of these industries is rich enough for the simple reason that we really do not have enough power plants, enough good apartment buildings, or enough oil wells or oil refineries. Speaking for myself, as a consumer, I must say that I would like Con Edison, the landlords of New York City, the oil industry, and so on, all to be worth many more billions than they are presently worth. I would benefit from that fact. If Con Ed had more power plants, my supply of electricity would be assured. If the landlords had more and better buildings, I would have a better apartment. If the oil industry had more wells and refineries, I would have a more abundant and secure supply of oil products. If one thinks about it, I believe, nothing could be more absurd than consumers in a capitalist economy attacking the wealth of their suppliers. That wealth serves them. They are the physical beneficiaries of it. All of the wealth of the utilities, the landlords, the oil companies, where is it? It is in power plants and power lines, apartment buildings, oil wells and oil refineries. And whom does it actually physically serve? It serves the consumers. It serves us, all of us. We have a selfish interest in the preservation and increase of that wealth. If we deprive Con Ed of a power plant, we deprive ourselves of power. If we deprive our landlords of more and better buildings, we deprive ourselves of apartments. If we deprive the oil industry of wells and refineries, we deprive ourselves of gasoline and heating oil. This harmony of interest between the consumer and the producer under capitalism is one of the great, profound insights of von Mises. Because of it, even if businessmen become cowardly and do not fight for their own interests, we, as consumers, must fight for them, or more correctly, for ourselves. Because we have a selfish interest in being able to pay prices that make it profitable for businessmen to supply us. It is to our self-interest to pay utility rates, rents, oil prices, and so on, that enable the producers in these fields to keep their facilities intact and growing, and that make them want to supply us. And I must say, in view of the principles we have learned in the last several weeks, that we do not have to worry about being charged unfairly in a free market, because any high profits that might be made from us are simply the incentive and the means to an expanded supply, and are made only because of special efficiency on the part of the producers, or because, temporarily, investment in the industry has been deficient, which deficiency the profits remedy. Now let us try to keep in mind all that we have learned tonight about shortages and about the ignorance that surrounds them, and let us turn to the kind of ignorance that displayed itself during the oil shortage. I am concentrating on the oil shortage in this course because it had such a dramatic effect on practically everyone in the United States, and because it is so illustrative of all of the problems associated with controls, including the kinds of evasions that are associated with them. There were two very popular explanations of the oil shortage that went around at the time, both of which tried to blame it on the oil companies rather than on price controls. According to one of these explanations, the oil companies had created the shortage in order to be able to obtain permission to build the Alaskan oil pipeline, which had been delayed for many years by the lawsuits of the ecology movement. According to the second explanation, the oil companies had created the shortage in order to eliminate the independent gas stations, to which they were reportedly observed denying supplies. Now, the first observation which must be made against both of these claims is that they do not see that shortages can only result from a price that is too low and must disappear as the price rises. To repeat once again, no matter how physically limited is the supply of a good or how urgent the demand for it, no shortage can possibly exist at the price established in a free market, because the price established in a free market will be high enough to level the quantity of the good demanded down to equality with the supply that exists, all the while, of course, acting to expand the supply that exists. Even if one could establish, which one certainly cannot, that the oil companies had conspired to reduce the supply of oil, still one could not blame them for the shortage. Had they reduced the supply of oil, they would have sold it at a higher price, and at the higher price, there would have been no shortage. In order to blame the oil companies for the shortage, one would have to show that the oil companies deliberately charged too low a price for their oil. That would be the only conceivable way that they could have caused the shortage. But that is absolutely absurd. It was not the oil companies who were responsible for too low a price, but the government with its price controls. The government stood ready to fine, or possibly even imprison, anyone selling oil or oil products at prices that would have eliminated the shortage. The interests of justice, however, require that I show not only that the oil companies could not have caused the shortage, but also that they were not responsible for anything acting to raise the price of oil in the absence of controls. Observe, the oil companies were not responsible for the nationwide and worldwide increase in aggregate demand that has acted to drive up all prices, including, of course, the price of oil. Nor were the oil companies responsible for any decrease in the world supply of oil. Both were exclusively the result of government actions. All governments, that of the United States included, are, as we have seen, bent on reckless inflationary policies that act to raise the demand for everything and the price of everything. And it was governments that were responsible for the restriction in the supply of oil. Not only the governments that are members of the International Oil Cartel, or that participated in the Arab embargo, but the U.S. government. the U.S. government, acting largely under the influence of the ecology movement, restricted the supply of oil in the following ways. One, it delayed the development of the Alaskan oil fields for years. Two, it prevented the development of offshore oil wells on the continental shelf. Three, it stopped the construction of new refineries and of harbor facilities for handling supertankers. Four, it imposed price controls on oil. Five, more recently, it has acted to further restrict oil company profits by punitively increasing their rate of taxation through abolishing the customary depletion allowance on crude oil. This followed a reduction in the depletion allowance some years ago. Six, it has deterred investment in the oil industry through threats of antitrust actions forcing the breakup of existing companies and through threats of nationalization of the oil industry. In addition, the U.S. government has been responsible for an enormous artificial increase in the demand for oil, over and above the increase caused by its policy of inflation. It has caused an artificial increase in the demand for oil in the following ways. One, since the mid-1960s, it has controlled the price of natural gas, thereby undermining the growth of that industry. The demand for fuel that normally would have been supplied by natural gas has therefore overflowed largely into an expanded demand for petroleum, which is its closest substitute for most purposes. Two, under the influence of the ecology movement, the government has prevented the construction of atomic power plants and restricted the mining of coal. In these ways, too, it has forced the demand for fuel to rely more heavily than necessary on oil supplies. Three, again under the influence of the ecology movement, the government has forced electric utilities to shift from the burning of coal to the burning of oil, and it has forced automobile manufacturers to produce engines requiring far higher gasoline consumption per ton mile. In sum, the government and the ecology movement have done everything in their power to raise the demand for and restrict the supply of oil. Now, it should be realized that it is only these actions of the U.S. government that have made possible the dramatic rise in the price of oil. The U.S. government bears a far greater responsibility than the Arab cartel. It is the party that has made it possible for the cartel to succeed. All that the cartel has done is to take advantage of the artificial increase in demand and restriction of supply brought about by the U.S. government. Had the U.S. government not restricted the expansion of the domestic petroleum industry and forced up the demand for oil, the supply reductions carried out by the cartel would not have been able to have a significant effect on the price. Because in that context, such supply reductions would have been at the expense of far less important wants than actually turned out to be the case. With the larger domestic supply of oil and competing fuels that a free market would have produced, the marginal significance of any given amount of oil would have been far less. The loss of any given amount of oil, by virtue of the supply reductions carried out by the cartel, would therefore have been far less serious. As a result, the cartel would not have been able to raise the price nearly as much by virtue of any given amount of supply reduction. In such circumstances, the cartel members would probably have not found it worthwhile to reduce the supply. Indeed, the cartel would probably never have even been formed in the first place, because the conditions required for its success would have been totally lacking. In sharpest contrast to the actions of the U.S. government, at each step of the way, the oil companies have sought to expand the production of crude oil and oil products in order to keep pace with the growing demand for oil. They have consistently sought to develop new sources of supply, such as the Alaskan and offshore fields, and to construct new refineries and improved harbor facilities. In other words, they have done everything in their power to keep the price of oil products as low as economically possible. Any other policy would have been against their interests. And this point must be stressed. In a free market, the oil company's profit motive is tied to maintaining as great a supply and as low a price of oil as possible. Consider first the interests of the firms that are predominantly petroleum refiners. Their capital is invested primarily in refineries, pipelines, tankers, delivery trucks, and the like, rather than in deposits of crude oil in the ground. These firms clearly have an interest in the greatest possible supply and lowest possible price of crude oil, because the price of crude oil is their cost. These firms have the same interest in an abundant supply and low price of crude oil that every producer has in an abundant supply and low price of his raw material. By the same token, consider the interests of the producers of crude oil. Their interests lie with the greatest possible efficiency of refining operations and the lowest possible price of refined petroleum products. Because the lower the prices of refined products, the greater the quantity of them demanded, and therefore the greater the quantity of crude oil demanded. The price of crude oil can benefit by part of any cost savings in refining. This mutual tension between the interests of refiners and producers of crude oil makes it necessary for each group to try to improve its own production. Because if the existing producers of crude oil lag behind, they can expect competition from the refiners, who can develop their own supplies of crude oil or expand their existing crude oil operations. If the existing refiners lag behind, they can expect competition from the producers of crude oil, who for their part can undertake refining operations or expand their existing refining operations. In addition, both groups can expect competition from total outsiders if they fail to exploit any significant opportunity for improvement. And of course, within each group, whichever individual firm succeeds in improving production ahead of its rivals will almost certainly gain at their expense. For example, if one particular refiner improves his efficiency and cuts his costs, he will have higher profits and thus be able to accumulate additional capital. It will almost certainly pay him to use his additional capital to expand his production and to create a market for his additional production by lowering his price. His lower costs will still enable him to have high profits, even at lower prices, and his lower prices will both attract new customers to the industry and take away some customers from rivals who cannot afford to sell at such low prices. Any refiner who does not strive to cut his costs and expand his output merely creates an opportunity for someone else to do so, whether another existing refiner, a crude oil producer, or a total outsider. And he thereby risks making himself the rival who cannot afford to sell at the market price. That is, he risks the destruction of his firm if he does not strive to reduce costs. In the same way, every producer of crude oil has similar profit as well as loss incentives to cut his costs and develop new supplies at lower prices. For these reasons, it was no accident, but logically necessary, that the oil companies have all along sought to expand their production. It was the operation of these very principles that brought the oil industry into existence in the first place and developed it from virtually nothing into the productive giant it is today. To argue, therefore, that the oil companies were responsible for the shortage is an absurdity compounded by a triple injustice. It is an absurdity in that, as we have seen, it implicitly accuses the oil companies of charging too low a price for their oil. This is something they would never do, and the critics of the oil industry should be the last ones on earth to accuse them of doing it, if those critics had any understanding of the cause of shortages. The accusation embodies a triple injustice in that it evades, one, the fact that it was the government's price controls that kept the price too low. Two, the fact that the government and the ecology movement did everything they could to restrict the supply and expand the demand for oil. And three, the fact that by the nature of the profit motive, the oil companies have always worked to expand the supply of oil and reduce its price. To argue in addition that the oil companies created the shortage for the purpose of being able to build the Alaskan pipeline is to pile on still further absurdities. The obvious truth, given the price controls, is that the construction of the pipeline would have mitigated the shortage somewhat, had it not been so long delayed. To argue that its construction was the motive for the shortage is not only to display the utmost ignorance about the causation of shortages and callous indifference to the most elementary questions of justice, it is also to display a lack of comprehension of the law of causality in relation to the physical world. Because according to this argument, the pipeline was something that only the oil companies wanted. The consumers of oil products, allegedly, could have gotten along quite well without the pipeline. Oil products, according to the mentality behind this argument, simply come from oil companies. The oil companies, it is believed, are perfectly capable of producing oil products without oil fields or oil pipelines. The oil companies desire oil fields and oil pipelines, one gets the impression, not because they are necessary to production. Production is causeless. But in order to disturb the reindeer and the grizzly bears and to pollute the air. This denial of the elementary physical connection between products and the means of producing them, I must point out, is not an isolated phenomenon confined to the arguments about the pipeline. It is simply a further manifestation of the same mentality we have already encountered in consumers who denounce the wealth of their suppliers. Consumers will be damned if they let the utility that supplies them with power own the power plants necessary to do so, or their landlord own a decent building in which they might live. This mentality pervades the whole ecology movement. It is the mentality of all of its members insofar as they both prevent the development of energy supplies and denounce the producers of energy for not producing enough. Now let us turn to the second version of the argument that the oil companies were responsible for the shortage, namely the claim that they created it for the purpose of eliminating the independent gas stations by denying them supplies. It may very well be the case that the oil companies did cut off or discriminatorily reduce supplies to the independents, as widely reported. My own personal experience does not confirm this, but I am willing to believe it. Not because it was reported in the press, but because it would have been a logical consequence of the shortage. Given the existence of the oil shortage, every oil company that owned gas stations had the following choice. Either it could reduce supplies to its own gas stations, where it was its capital that was invested and which stood to suffer loss if the stations had to close or restrict operations for lack of gasoline to sell, or it could reduce supplies to gas stations owned by others, where it was other people's capital that was invested and would suffer loss. Naturally, if an oil company or anyone else is confronted with the choice of having to lose its own capital as a result of some absurd government action, or allowing the loss to fall on the capital of someone else, it will choose the latter. And there is no moral reason why it should not. It is no one's moral obligation to offer up his wealth to the government's ignorance so that he may suffer his fair share, in quotes, of the damage it inflicts. I must point out that if it were not for the controls and the shortage, the oil companies and the independents would have enjoyed a perfectly harmonious, mutually profitable relationship as they always did in all the years before the controls and the shortages. An oil company benefits from the existence of independent stations willing to sell its gasoline and has absolutely no reason to try to undermine them, but every reason to try to promote them. Its benefit is that it can sell more gasoline without having to supply the capital necessary to buy or build gas stations. Even if the oil company owns some of its own gas stations, it still benefits from selling to independents. In just the same way that a company like Howard Johnson's or Schraft's benefits by being able to sell its ice cream through retail outlets it does not own. The benefit is wider marketability of the product. An oil company benefits by selling to independent stations even if they are in direct competition with stations it owns, because it is better that it supply the competing stations than that some other oil company do so. If that happened, it would still have the same competition, but it would sell less gasoline. In the absence of price controls, even the physical scarcity of oil would not have stopped the oil companies from selling to the independents. They would have been glad to sell whenever an independent was in a position to pay a higher wholesale price than their own stations. I cannot help noting that this whole argument about the oil companies being out to eliminate the independents, or even just being out to build the Alaskan pipeline, and allegedly staging a nationwide, worldwide crisis to do it, introduces a strange element into the discussion. And that is the element of alleged secret plots, dark conspiracies, evil forces, and all the rest of that syndrome. In view of all that we have proved about the oil shortage, I believe I am justified when I say that these arguments really deserve no greater intellectual respectability than the fear some unfortunate people have of Martians or the evil eye or whichever. Certainly, they should not have been taken seriously by the media, although there are scientists today who are now taking the Loch Ness Monster seriously. To the extent I have not already done so, I am now going to begin demonstrating how price controls and shortages disrupt every single benevolent function of the principles we developed in relation to a free market and create an all-pervasive state of chaos in production and distribution. Please recall that in our discussion of the free market, we saw how the uniformity of profit principle kept the production of the various goods in proper balance and gave to consumers the power of positive initiative to shift production from one industry to another. Our discussion in the first part of tonight's lecture enables us to see how these things cease to be possible under price controls. If the price of something is controlled below its cost, or more correctly, below its cost plus the rate of profit its producers can earn in other industries, that something will cease to be produced. It does not matter how essential it is, nor how urgently the consumers may desire it. Such a price control is tantamount to a simple prohibition of the production of the good. If the price is controlled below the cost merely of part of the potential free market supply, the part that would be produced, say, by relatively less efficient producers or under less favorable circumstances, then the price control is tantamount to a prohibition of the production of part of the supply of the good. In either case, the uniformity of profit principle is prevented from doing its job. The production of the good either does not occur at all, or it does not occur in a sufficient quantity, and the consumers are totally deprived of the power to make it otherwise. In the question period last week, someone asked what argument one could give to a tenant to convince him to be against rent controls. This discussion indicates a very simple argument to give to any consumer against a price control on any product. and that is that if he wants the good, he must be willing to pay the necessary price. It is a natural law that a good can only be supplied in the long run if its price covers its cost of production plus the going rate of profit. If the price is controlled below this point, then, as we have just seen, it is equivalent to a prohibition of the production of the good. Now, it is simply absurd for a consumer who wants a good to support a measure that prohibits its production. And that is what one should tell him. That is what all of us should tell all the legislators who are busy enacting price control laws for our alleged benefit. These would-be benefactors of ours are destroying the people we need to supply us. They are prohibiting us from making it worthwhile for other people to supply us. In effect, they are interfering with our right to employ agents to act in our behalf. They are reducing us to the point where if we want anything, we will have to produce it ourselves, because their price controls will make it unprofitable for anyone to produce it for us. If our legislators are able to go on benefiting us long enough with their price controls, they will benefit us all the way back to feudalism. Now, this discussion that we have just had largely still relates to the effects of price controls alone. From this point on, I am going to systematically develop the consequences of price controls acting in conjunction with the shortages they create. The powerlessness of consumers under price controls is a good starting point for this discussion. Because the combination of price controls and shortages not only deprives the consumer of the power to make it profitable for sellers to produce the goods he wants, but of all economic power of any kind over sellers. Instead of being a valued customer whose patronage or lack of patronage makes a difference to the seller's profit or loss, the buyer is reduced to the status of absolute insignificance, totally at the seller's mercy. His position is much worse, in fact, than if he were dealing with a protected legal monopolist. Consider, if a shortage exists and a buyer is dissatisfied with his supplier, he dare not leave him because he has nowhere else to go. In a shortage, even if there are many other suppliers of the same good, each of them has his own waiting line or waiting list, and as a result, the dissatisfied customer of any one supplier cannot count on actually being supplied by any other supplier. The other suppliers, therefore, do not represent a real alternative for him in a shortage. As a result, no matter how many sellers of a good there may be, price controls and shortages place each of them in the position of being the only one. And just as in the case of a protected legal monopolist, these sellers are immune from potential competition. The threat of potential competition in a free market would keep in check the occasional sellers who are in the position of being sole suppliers. Potential competition is ruled out because the industry is forced to operate at a rate of return that is not competitive, and perhaps even at an outright loss. Consequently, no outside firm would want to enter such an industry. Up to this point, we can see that the position of a seller under price controls and shortages at least duplicates that of a protected legal monopolist with respect to the buyer's lack of freedom of choice. Now let us see how the situation is actually much worse. Please observe that under price controls and shortages, the seller who surpasses a customer's limits of tolerance and succeeds in driving him away does not lose anything by doing so. Because for each customer he drives away, there is a multitude of others eager to take his place. The seller simply sells to someone else who otherwise would not have been able to buy or not buy as much as he desired. Now, this goes beyond the conditions faced by a protected legal monopolist. Such a monopolist does not have a reserve of unsupplied potential customers willing to buy on just as good terms as his present customers. If such a monopolist drives away his present customers, he can only find new ones at lower prices. A protected legal monopolist who has any sense, therefore, will not do this. He will value his customers because he knows that he cannot afford to lose them without harming himself. But under price controls and shortages, the seller is free to regard his customers as absolutely valueless, as being instantaneously replaceable by others drawn from waiting lines or waiting lists without any loss to himself.